This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the spooky minisode,
where this week we're gonna read you some creepypastas to get you in the Halloween spirit.
Exactly, and we're excited.
Yeah, for some spooky spaghettis.
Some spooky skeddies.
I was telling Sarah this before we started. I don't know about you if you've ever delved into creepypastas person. I'm the worst. But we always think that they're good, like, right up until the end. The end is always where it's like, it could have been better.
And it could have always, like, gone on more, I feel like.
I don't agree.
Depending
on... Some of them are far too long.
Some of the smaller ones, I'm like, you could have explained this much more, it would have been creepier.
Yeah, that's fair, that's fair. I think because I love being brief, that I'm like, give it to me straight and scary. But... I don't even know if these are spooky, but here we go. This is called The Decaying Mall. There is a dead mall somewhere in Virginia that is in an advanced state of decay. For one reason or another, the mall still stands. There have been several plans, some of them quite elaborate, to revitalize the area, many of them calling for the original building's demolition. But none of them have ever come to pass. I feel like that's true of all malls, you know?
I feel like that's Sarasota Square Mall.
And DeSoto.
And DeSoto.
Yeah.
And Southgate.
Yep. It is quite a shame, a sorry thing to look at today. In its heyday, in the 1970s and early 80s, the mall was jam-packed, the place to be on the weekends, especially Saturday nights. It was upscale, fashionable, and always a happy place to go. Years went by, and bigger, better malls opened around the city. The mall slowly started losing tenants, until today it is completely empty. The real villain here is capitalism.
That's the end of the story.
Just, I cut it in 30 seconds. If you go in it nowadays, you will be astounded by the vast emptiness. Every step you make and every word you speak will echo loudly. Where once scores of people did their shopping, met for lunch, and got together, there is now only eerie silence. Over the years, the happy, upbeat feeling of the place has darkened, more and more, until now many people avoid it, but can never tell you exactly why. The story would end here, were it not for a very curious rumor. It is said on certain Saturday nights, throughout the year, something very strange happens. If you go to one of the entrances of this mall, it will be unlocked. Push open the door, and it will give way, and you may enter. Near a bench right in the entrance will be a shadowy figure, casting a shadow that obscures then the darkness around it. That's a bad sentence, too. That obscures the darkness around it. This shadowy figure can be spoken to. Call out to it, "I know your secrets and the secrets you keep." Where once there was shadow, there will appear a face, a radiantly pale, withered old man's face with black holes for eye sockets. "No," he will respond in a voice that will be like the slithering of maggots. "Oh, I can't do that, for I know yours." He will then ask a question. The question will be about your life, or rather a detail about your life, something that happened many years ago. The question he poses will be one you should know the answer to, but so obscure it will be difficult to answer at first, if you can answer it at all. You'll be forced to answer. You simply won't be able to respond with, "I don't know." If you get the answer right, the shadowy man will thrust a box into your hands before dissolving into the darkness. Open the box, and there will be a note on which will be written the name of the person you are meant to marry or fall in love with. One rarely is the person you think it will be. If you get the answer wrong, your body will be found the morning of the following Sunday, at the entrance to the mall you came in, mutilated and eviscerated so badly, no one will be able to identify the body.
Ooh, spooky.
That's really... a catch 22, you know?
It is. Like, just don't do it then.
Yeah. Like, honestly, do you need to know that badly?
Like, just live out your life and then get married.
Yeah. And then, like, see, I can already tell, like, I already know myself that I would immediately be like, but what if it's not the right person? I should go into that mall and see.
That's why we're in a modern society and there's a thing called divorce.
That is very true.
Alrighty, so I have one next, and it is called Kids in the Dark. Growing up poor in the Deep South meant sharing a lot with my little brother Ollie. Most often, we'd pass toys, clothes, and skin conditions between us.
What?
I don't know.
Sorry.
Up until he was 6, we even shared a bed. Neither one of us was happy about that. It was my 10th birthday when that changed. I got one present that year, and it was a bed of my own. Ollie was jealous right away, and I could understand why. He had to keep that half-broken-down frame with the worn-out mattress. The one I'd gotten wasn't much better, but not being broken and worn was enough. Sleeping apart was a great feeling. It was freedom. No longer would I have to suffer the sudden and inexplicable kicks to the stomach. No longer would I wake up with Ollie's foot pressed into my neck like he'd stepped on Dracula the night before. At least that's what I thought. Right away, right after I got the new bed, the shriek started. At first, I thought Ollie woke up in the middle of the night and screamed because he'd gotten scared. Then the sound echoed through the tiny room again, and I knew it wasn't a normal cry. The room was always black as pitch after sunset. The one window we had was pressed against a long leaf pine, and even the biggest, brightest moon cast no light inside. The shriek just about drove me crazy. Every night, probably at the exact same time, these sharp yelps would knock me out of my dreams. It wasn't my mom or dad yelling either. I knew what that sounded like, believe me. Most worrying of all was the fact that I could never tell where it was coming from. It seemed completely random. One night, it'd come somewhere near the closet. The next night, it'd shoot from a corner of the ceiling. Any hope I'd have of having my own space would get dashed every time as Ollie would silently slip into bed with me, shaking like crazy. He'd clasp onto me and wouldn't let go until it was almost daybreak. Most times I'd take his hand and tell him everything was going to be okay, that it'd be over by morning, but I was never really sure. Over time, the shriek started changing. At first it was only by small degrees, but eventually it took on the primal hooting sound of a primate calling out its fierce warning. I had to clasp pillows to my ears just to keep from going deaf. Mom and Dad never believed me or Ollie, basically because the thing, whatever it was, refused to make a peep when they were in the room. Apparently, they couldn't even hear it through the walls, even though I was damn sure it was loud enough. The shriek just got worse and worse until I felt like I couldn't take it anymore. Me and Ollie were doing really bad in school, and we just had no energy at all. I could sleep more deeply with my head propped up and eyes open in the middle of class than I could in my own room at night. Then, thankfully, we moved out of the house nearly a year later. I'd contemplated all sorts of things, even a child's clumsy concept of suicide, just to get away from the horrific nightly noise. There was no problem at the next house. It was a nice, white, cookie-cutter home on a dead-end street, and I welcomed the normalcy. What's more, when we moved in there, there was a bunk bed waiting for me and Ollie. No more broken bed, no more second bed I ended up having to share anyways. The only problem was deciding who'd get the top bunk. I told Ollie I deserved it. After all, I had gotten a new bed way back and he ruined it by climbing in every night. What? He shook his head. I never did that. I'd always wonder why the noise stopped the second I was sharing my bed. Now I had the answer.
Spooky.
Spooky Halloween.
Gross.
Yeah. Scary AF.
All right.
That one was actually pretty good, I feel
yeah,
like.
Yeah, that one is good. I was creeped out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it is really hard to do that, you know, in a short story. Yeah. And, like, I can shit on creepypastas all I want, but I would never be able to write anything even remotely close to being scary. So exactly. I actually have nowhere to talk. But let me tell you my second tale for today.
Do it. I'm ready.
This is called It Started as a Leak. The rainy season began in early summer, and June had been no exception. It did not surprise the man when he discovered rainwater dripping from his dining room ceiling. Shrugging it off, he placed a tall pot beneath the leak and expected it to stop on its own. However, it continued to rain, and before he knew it, the pot would threaten to overflow. He had to dump the water out first thing in the morning and straight after he returned home from work. Eventually, he began to notice water damage at the source of the leak. The white ceiling had discolored, turning a dull shade of brown. He checked the weather and realized that it would continue to rain sporadically over the next 10 days. The man was worried about the ceiling mildewing and becoming an expensive repair, so he called a local handyman. Unfortunately, the man could not sign to have the repairs done, only his landlord could. It was a frustrating policy. The man called his landlord, but could not reach him. He left him a few voicemails detailing how the damage was becoming progressively worse. The man was clueless as to why his landlord would not return his calls. They usually kept in touch, speaking at least twice a month. Finally, he reasoned that he would not be held accountable for any damages sustained. One night, the man was startled awake by a massive thump. He quickly turned on his bedside lamp, and just vaguely, he could see an overturned table and a large shape laying across it. He sprinted out of his apartment and called the police, gagging at the smell. The man sat in the police station with a blanket wrapped around his shoulders and a coffee mug resting in his hands. He did know one thing. There had been a dead body in his ceiling, and the water had saturated it so badly that it caved under the weight. So far, the body was unidentifiable due to the rainwater and was being autopsied. While the man waited, he called his landlord and finally reached him, panicking as he explained the situation. His landlord was just as alarmed, and the man pleaded for him to come to the station while he made his statement. The man paused as a detective crossed over to him, and he lowered his phone, wondering if the body had been identified. His blood ran immediately cold, and he shook his head with terror. The body belonged to Richard Thompson, his landlord, and he had died over a year ago. That's not what disturbed him the most. If his landlord was dead, then who was pretending to be him?
The killer.
Spooky. Also, though, like, you're a murderer, but also then just pretending to be a landlord.
Like, the most boring of jobs.
Yeah, that would just not be fun at all.
All right. We've got one more.
Yes.
This one's a tiny bit longer.
All right. Give it to us.
So buckle up. This one is called Mr. Smile. It was in early November of 1997 that a series of very strange sessions led a child psychologist in Maine to contact the authorities. It began when the patient of his began to tell him about one of their friends. This friend being imaginary, as far as both the psychologist and the boy's parents were concerned. He called his friend Mr. Smile and would talk about him at great length during some sessions. The boy called him Mr. Smile, both because he would always be smiling, and because when he was around, the boy said everything felt happy. He said there was a feeling of everything being okay. The boy in question was being treated for serious issues to do with anger and depression, but when Mr. Smile was around, he said that all of that anger and sadness seemed to just disappear. He said that Mr. Smile wouldn't speak, but rather just stand there at the foot of his bed. He smelled like candy floss, and just by being there, he made the boy feel calm and safe. The psychiatrist assumed this imaginary friend was some sort of coping mechanism the boy had developed to deal with the problems at home that had led to his violent temper, and thought nothing much of it. Until another patient, a girl about 9 years old, also began talking about her imaginary friend, Mr. Smile. And then a boy of 7, and then a boy of 12, and then a girl of 11. All in all, close to 15 separate patients all began to talk to him about Mr. Smile. The first few he'd put down to coincidence. After all, many children have imaginary friends, and the name and description of Mr. Smile were just generic enough that it didn't concern him too much at first. But as more and more of his patients told him about Mr. Smile, he began to grow concerned. He asked for more details. Every single one of them described him the same way, using the exact same words. Now, there was no way that all of these children could be in contact with each other. 5 of them, for instance, were currently being homeschooled, and according to their parents, when we spoke to them, never even really left the house, except when it was to accompany them on shopping trips and the like. There was no way that every single one of these kids could have rehearsed or prepared their statements together, which led him to a deeply disturbing conclusion. He spoke privately with each of the children's parents, one at a time. He avoided disclosing too much information, but told them that something troubling had cropped up in multiple sessions with various patients, and that he believed that there was a chance that their child was at risk. He asked for their permission to discuss matters with the authorities, and the parents gave their consent, provided that they were kept in the loop as to what was going on. And so, over the course of the next week, the police came and talked to their children about their friend. They asked for details about his appearance, which they couldn't seem to describe apart from the smile and that he was not like them. How he got into their house, anything he said or did while he was there. Because by this point, the psychiatrists, the parents, and the police were all convinced that Mr. Smile was quite real and quite dangerous, the authorities had checked to make sure there were no known predators living in the area, which they had confirmed was not the case. But it was quite clear that whoever this Mr. Smile was, he was a real person who had been sneaking into the homes of these children at night. None of the children claimed to know how he got in. They said they would just wake up and he'd be standing there at the foot of his bed. Sometimes they said he would be singing something, but not in English. It sounded like a lullaby, they said. It made them feel safe. Finally, the children were asked to draw Mr. Smile, as they couldn't put into words how he looked. Each and every one of the children picked up a red crayon and proceeded to color in the entire page until it was just a rectangle of red. Then, when asked about this, they insisted that they had drawn Mr. Smile. When asked where his head, arms, and legs were, they would insist that they had drawn those. They claimed that they had drawn a perfect picture of the man at the foot of their bed, and when they were told that they had simply colored in the page and not drawn anything at all, they became deeply angry, feeling like they were being accused of lying and insisting that what they had drawn was a picture of the man they had seen. Acting more on a hunch than anything else, the psychiatrist decided to show one of the colored in rectangles to the various children and ask them what it was. each and every one of them, with no knowledge of what the picture was supposed to be or who had drawn it, replied that it was a picture of Mr. Smile. Cameras and baby monitors were placed in the children's rooms so they could see they could be monitored. Many of the parents simply stopped sleeping altogether, staying up all night staring at the screens that displayed where their children slept. At no point did anyone enter or exit the bedrooms. No sounds except for them snoring or occasionally talking in their sleep were heard over the baby monitors. There was no sign of Mr. Smile. After almost 2 weeks of this, many of them began to doubt that Mr. Smile ever existed. Other psychiatrists since have put the whole thing down to some strange shared delusion that, while it couldn't be explained yet, didn't have any basis in reality. Some suggested that maybe this whole Mr. Smile thing had its basis in a TV show or film that the children had all watched, leading them to dream up something similar. Then one of the boys went missing. The camera in his room had gone dead at about 2 in the morning. His mother had run to check on him, only to find his room empty. It had literally taken her less than a minute to run to his room. There was no possible way for him to leave or be taken and be out of her sight in the time it took to leave her bedroom and run towards his, but he was gone. She said there was a smell like cotton candy in the room. The search for the boy turned up nothing. No one had seen anything strange or unusual around the time before or during the disappearance, and no trace of him was ever found. It was less than a week later that one of the girls who had spoken of Mr. Smile vanished as well. Then another of the boys. One by one, each of them began to disappear, until only 4 remained. The 4 remaining children began to talk about how Mr. Smile and his friends were going to take them away soon. When asked about these friends, they talked about how Mr. Smile lived with the other smiling men in the happy place and that he would take them there soon. They said that there were lots of people there already and that in the happy place, everything was beautiful. They said that they knew about it because Mr. Smile talked to them in their heads because he couldn't talk like other people did, and he would show them pictures in their heads of the place they were going. Things began to get increasingly disturbing. After a few weeks, the children began complaining of headaches and nausea. Their schools reported that they began to suffer hallucinations, and 2 of them started complaining that they didn't like the place that Mr. Smile was showing them anymore. One began screaming for half an hour, acting as if they were having a fit and screaming for the colors to stop, that the colors were horrible and that they needed them to go away. One of the children claimed that Mr. Smile was talking to them in their head all the time now and was telling them things, terrible things, but that they couldn't talk about it, that they mustn't because their parents would know about the terrible things too. The psychiatrist asked them to write down what Mr. Smile was saying, promising he would show it to no one, managing to gain trust of one of the boys enough that he agreed. The contents of the book are known only to him and the authorities, but whenever anyone involved has been asked about it, they get real quiet and quickly find an excuse to change the subject. The children stopped sleeping. Footage from security cameras showed them sitting bolt upright with their eyes unblinking, just staring at the wall without moving or making a sound. Sedatives did nothing. One of the girls began cutting strange circular marks into her skin, while 2 of the boys ceased communicating in English altogether. The language they spoke was never identified, and despite numerous people asking them to being asked to listen to them, they could not translate what they were saying. By the start of 1999, all 4 children had vanished into thin air. There was no trace of who took them. Searches have turned up nothing to this day, with no indication of where they are, or if they're even dead or alive. No suspects have ever been found either. All 4 of them appeared to simply vanish into thin air, much like the others, all of whom also remain missing, their disappearances unexplained.
Spooky.
So creeps. Children are creepy.
Children are super creepy. I could, like, literally just read stories of, like, creepy things that children did, and that would freak me out mm-hmm. the most, because I don't like it.
Yeah.
Me either. But also, Mr. Smile sounds horrifying.
Right? Apparently he's just a red square.
Yeah. Or he's just so horrible that you envision him as an aggressive red square.
Very true.
You know?
Red is an aggressive color.
It is an aggressive color. It's hard to say. It makes me aggressively hungry.
Like McDonald's? Kidding.
Yeah. That's why
I got that psychology joke. Yeah.
We hope that you guys enjoyed a couple of spooky tales, you know, get you in the mood for Halloween.
Exactly.
Because it is almost Halloween weekend. And Sarah's birthday.
Yay! I'll be an adult.
You already are an adult, but good, you're right. We hope that you guys liked this. If you did, make sure to leave us a 5-star review wherever you can leave those, mostly Apple Podcasts.
And please check us out on all of our social media. We're at Crime Binge or Crime Binge Podcast everywhere.
Yes. And if you ever want to submit a spooky story to us, you can do so at crimebinge.com.
Exactly.
Yeah. And keep on binging. Bye.
Remain spooky.